philosophy.
Here we go.
He has published numerous articles, both online and in print, including The Future of Online Learning, Learning Objects, Resource Profiles, and E-Learning 2.0. He is a popular speaker, appearing at hundreds of events and around the world over the last 15 years. He has obtained a Bachelor of Arts and Masters of Arts in Philosophy from the University of Calgary, specialising in, that's a big word, Epistemology and the Philosophy of Science. He also studied at a PhD level at the University of Alberta, completing all but his dissertation. Presenting via Illuminate in true e-learning version 2.0, please give a clap symbol for Stephen Downs. Thank you.
Yes, we're getting a little bit of feedback from that microphone. I'll monitor the chat window to make sure the sound is okay. If you're having any issues with the sound, please let me know. I hope you're seeing me in coarse grays right now, and maybe I'll make that a little bit nicer. So there I am in fine colors, and looks like stop motion. So we'll go back to coarse grays. I'm not going to leave this little video up, but I wanted you to see what it looks like at this end of the world. And basically what you see behind me is a wall and a clock showing that it's just a bit before 11 p.m. here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you today. The topic of the talk, I had a little fun with the title, as you can see, Exploring the Horizon of Online Learning. And that was a bit of a reaction to the title of the conference. And of course, there's E this and I that. And I wanted to focus on something a little bit different. I wanted to focus on, I don't know what color ATM, I don't know what the ATM means. Sorry, it's just responding to the moderator there. I wanted to look not so much at the E and the I, not so much at the technology. Oh, I see, okay. But at more the openness. And so the O in Horizon stands for open online learning. And that'll be most of the focus of the talk today. It doesn't mean we're not going to do online learning. Doesn't mean we're not going to throw a little bit of tech at you. But I'll keep it moderate and the squiggles to a minimum. The scene you're looking at there on the main screen is a scene from the province of Manitoba, Canada. I used to work in Manitoba. I worked at an agriculture and trades college called Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba. And that's pretty much what it looked like where I lived. And it was one of these places, right? And you may have heard the joke. The dog runs away and you can see it running away for the next 3 days. That's how flat the land is. And It was an interesting place to live and an interesting place to work. And I remember one day I was driving up Highway 2 as fast as I could go from Brandon up to a place called Russell, Manitoba. Russell, Manitoba is the hometown, for those of you who follow hockey, which maybe none of you, of Theo Fleury. An interesting place. And I was pulled over by the police because I was going perhaps a little bit too fast. And they looked at me a little bit strange because I looked kind of the way I look now, but imagine me with a big shaggy beard. So long hair, shaggy beard, speeding through rural Manitoba. And I'm driving a panel van. And they open up the panel van and it's crammed to the rafters with computers and wires and gear and all of that. And what I was doing, I was packing an entire computer network with me and headed to Russell and headed to various other communities in rural Manitoba to conduct workshops on the internet. This was in 1996, and they hadn't really rolled out the internet anywhere outside the urban centers in Canada. Certainly nothing we could do an entire network on. And what I took with me was a device, and some of you who have been around for a while may have heard of it, called a NetHopper. Now, what a NetHopper was a nifty little tool. You connected your NetHopper to the telephone. You made a long-distance phone call to some other place that was actually connected to the internet. In this case, it was a long-distance phone call back to Assiniboine Community College. And over that long-distance phone call, you would have your internet connection. So I was taking these networks with the NetHopper and all the computers and all the gear to different communities in rural Manitoba and showing them what the internet looked like, because they had no idea. And even in 1996, it was pretty impressive. You know, I have to tell you, it was pretty impressive. Let's jump forward 10 years. And in 2006, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the United Nations Development Program announced that it would back the laptop program called One Laptop Per Child, launched by Nicholas Negroponte. And the OLPC was a very ambitious initiative. The ambitious initiative was to provide millions of computers, wireless network-enabled computers, to developing nations around the world. Now, arguably, Nicholas Negroponte wasn't really the person to launch the project, and it never did reach the ambition, but it did have people like Walter Bender and Mary Lou Jepsen, who built what at the time was a revolutionary computer. Now it's kind of slow and clunky, and you know, the keyboards don't work, but then it was a very revolutionary computer. And even though only a few million of these were distributed, what happened was, I think, pivotal, because for the first time in about 15 years, maybe even more, we had a new kind of computer technology coming onto the market. A small, inexpensive computer that didn't do a whole lot, but you know, you could get it out to a lot of people, and what it did do reasonably well. Fast forward to, well, yesterday, and I ran an item in my newsletter on the story pictured here, where we have a bunch of Kindles that were distributed. And the caption from the story, if you follow the link, reads, "We loaded e-readers with about 80 books each, a combination of local textbooks and storybooks we have digitized, along with international books donated by Random House, including the entire Magic Tree House series," which I don't know at all, but I'll take their word for it. That's 40,000 books already delivered. Nearly impossible to contemplate without the use of e-readers. That's only 80 books on one of those machines. And I'm thinking, why not 800 books? Why not 8,000 books? And imagine now we've got a device that has 8,000 books or more that we're able to send to people for $100, $200, whatever, dollars a person. And it's a kind of distribution unimaginable even 10 years ago when I was driving networks in rural Manitoba, Canada. You know, we have gone through this before. We've gone through this before from the launch of the original printing press. And when Gutenberg launched his printing press back in 1439, the clock is not for effect. The clock is just telling me it's 11 o'clock. He wrote, "It is a press, certainly, but a press from which shall flow inexhaustible streams. A spring of truth shall flow from it. Like a new star, it shall scatter the darkness of ignorance and cause a light heretofore unknown to shine amongst men. Now, today we have a thing called Gutenberg. When we think of Gutenberg Online, we think of the Gutenberg Project. And the Gutenberg Project makes something like 30 or 40,000 books available for free to anybody who goes to it. And if you follow the link there to Gutenberg.org, you can find a lifetime of free reading. So we have the idea of the printing press. We have the idea of 30 or 40,000 free books. And we have the idea of these incredibly cheap e-readers. And there we are at this moment where, as Gutenberg said, a spring of truth shall flow from it. But you know, it doesn't happen by magic. If we think about what was needed for the Gutenberg press to have the impact that it did, I think there's three major stages that we go through. Language, literacy, and libraries. And the first of these is language. And if you think back to the history of what happened after Gutenberg launched his press, there was, you know, the Renaissance, the Reformation, there was Luther and Lutherism and Calvin and Calvinism and then the Industrial, etc., etc. But the very first thing that happened was a huge battle over language. Because the language of the day in the printed word was Latin, which of course was not the language of the day spoken by people in England who spoke English, or Germany, or the Germanic countries who spoke German. And the first thing that people had to do was to access the language, to have the capacity to print in their own language. And one of the major issues surrounding the rise of Lutheranism and Protestantism in general was the right to have the Bible printed in their own language. You know, and if we think about the printing of the King James Bible in English, that's a pivotal moment not only in the English language, not only in religion, but also in the history of printing. But having language open and free and accessible is not enough. You also have to have the capacity to use that language. You have to have literacy. And even for centuries after Gutenberg, literacy was something that belonged to, well, the literati, the well-educated, and generally the well-off. But as language grew in utility, so also literacy grew in importance. And so we get literacy programs, and we get the onset of public education and public reading programs, and finally our third phase, the public library. And the public library has its origins in places like colonial and United States, but now is a mainstay of pretty much every community, certainly across Canada, probably across Australia, across the United States, and around the world. And the library plays a major role in literacy, and literacy plays a major role in developing, propagating, and keeping alive the language. The library in these small towns in Canada that I took these networks to was a center of the community. The library, the school, and the hockey rink, those were where people congregated. Maybe not so many hockey rinks in Western Australia, but I'm sure you have your own analogy. I'm assuming rugby pitches or cricket pitches. I'm just guessing. It's got to be something like that. Not too much ice. And in Canada, what happened was when people were introduced to the internet and began to grasp the possibilities of the internet, they also grasped the importance of the internet as being central in the way that a library is central. And we developed in Canada something called the Community Access Program. And what that did is basically to put internet terminals in libraries in small towns across the country, also in large cities. But basically, we saw the internet and the library as performing much the same sort of function in these communities. Well, this is an idea that carries over to learning as well. And, you know, it's a more recent idea, perhaps, than public schooling and literacy programs in that. But the idea of open learning in the sense of open higher education, open colleges, and open universities is something that has taken hold this century. And there's probably, well, there's the big two, I would say. And the big two, the first of those, of course, is the Open University in Great Britain, which was established in 1969, with the first students enrolled in 1971, and now it has more than 180,000 students enrolled, including 25,000 students from overseas. Open University has a global audience. Since it was founded, more than 3 million students have gone through its courses. It's the largest academic institution in the United Kingdom and Europe by student number. By any account, it's a huge success, and it paved the way. It's dwarfed by Indira Gandhi National Open University, which was established in 1985. It has 3 million students. It's the largest university in the world, and of course, it's an open university. In Canada, we have Athabasca University. Before I worked for Assiniboine Community College, I worked for Athabasca University. And I'd drive my little Nissan Micra to the communities of northern Alberta, First Nations communities, small towns, community halls, delivering open education to those communities. In Australia, you have Open Universities Australia, which is done a bit differently. It's not a single institution, but rather a consortium of several universities and colleges, and the courses are offered through the universities and colleges. But the idea here of open learning is to create access, using whatever technologies are available, to education, in much the way we created access through whatever technologies were available to language. I draw that parallel deliberately because I think very seriously learning is the language of the 21st century. We think and speak in a language right now. It frames our thought. It creates the knowledge in our mind, but it's only language. What learning brings to us is, if you will, language plus. It's not just language anymore. It's language plus structures of knowledge, patterns of reasoning, ways of thinking, visioning, imagining. It's language plus video plus audio plus simulation plus practice and experience. All of these things combined. When you think of learning, if you were to imagine a unit of learning, whatever that may be, and we could argue about that till the sun goes down, that unit of learning today is like what a word was when Gutenberg is printing his press, pressing his print, whatever. It forms the basis of our society, the basis of our communication. You know, open universities have with them the history of not just open access, but also the embracing of technology to bring that access to the wider community. And Australia, interestingly, was the place where I heard about distance education for the very first time, the now famous and very well-known School of the Air. And, you know, I saw when I was in school as a kid, video from Australia, people on their sheep stations listening to wireless radio. And there's that aspect of open learning as well as the aspect of open access. And it brings to mind here the thought, the idea that there are different dimensions to open learning. It's not just, you know, a single thing. You set up the open learning thing and you're done. There are different phases, different ideas, different progressions of open learning. And that's what I want to focus on for the remainder of this talk. Now, Sir John Daniel, who was formerly a chancellor of the Open University and is now affiliated with the concept, Commonwealth of Learning. The Commonwealth of Learning is a Commonwealth organization promoting open learning throughout the Commonwealth and, with any luck, elsewhere. And he's been writing recently about different phases of open learning. He's adapting a model that was created by someone called James Taylor from the University of South Queensland. And this is with respect to a project that the Commonwealth of Learning is backing called Open Educational Resources University, OERU. And the diagram here on the screen, and I know the writing is probably a bit too small to see from where you're sitting, takes us through different phases of openness. Now, here's how Taylor depicts it, as interpreted by Sir John Daniel, where first you access courses based solely on open educational resources. Then there's open student support via Academic Volunteers International. Then there's open assessment from participating institutions. Then participating institutions grant credit for courses. And then finally, at the top, students are awarded credible degrees or credentials. And that's one way to put it. Even within that model, there's a lot of debate. The other link that I put on the screen links to a debate about whether these open educational resource universities should be for-profit or commercial entities or public entities. And already you sort of get this clash between different definitions of openness and what they mean. Can something be open if you charge money for it? Or does it have to be free? But if it has to be free, does it still count as open? These are the sorts of arguments that are going on right now in the field, and it can get, it wraps people up in a horrible wrangle at times. But let me step you through some of the phases that I've seen, and this is a different model from the one that we've just seen here. We begin with what are called open educational resources. And these have different histories depending on who you talk to, but the concept is always kind of the same. The concept is you have an educational resource, whether it's a book, perhaps digitized, an audio recording, a video, a training manual, again perhaps digitized, a simulator, whatever. It's an open it's an educational resource. If you take that resource and you apply appropriate licensing to it, that makes it an open educational resource. What sort of licensing? Well, many of you may have heard of something called Creative Commons. And if you haven't, I'll tell you about it. Creative Commons is the name of a license that you can apply to a resource, typically to a digital resource, that instead of reserving all rights the way a normal copyright would do, reserves only some rights. So I have a document, say, or a resource, say, the audio recording of this talk, which I'm making right now, by the way. And I put that online, I put it on my website, and I apply the license to it. And then I release that, and by the fact that I've applied a Creative Commons license to my resource, other people know that they can just take that resource and use it for free. Now, the Creative Commons licenses allow me to put different conditions on the release of that. I can require attribution so that they give me credit. I can stipulate that my resource is to be used only for non-commercial purposes, so they can't turn around and create, you know, Stephen Downes Commercial University out of all my stuff. I can require that if they mix my resource with other resources, that the license follows my resource. Or if I want, I can insist that my resource be distributed as is, without derivative works being created out of it. Creative Commons license allows people to release their resources in such a way as to promote reuse. In the world of technology, there's a whole infrastructure has developed around the reuse of educational resources. I've linked to a few of the projects. There's something called IMS Learning Object Metadata, which was then standardized by IEEE, and so now it's called IEEE Learning Object Metadata. And that's simply a mechanism for formally describing these resources. Learning Object Metadata may apply to any resource, whether it's an open resource or a commercial resource. But the idea here is that there is a mechanism for describing what's in a resource. And the reason for that is to make the resource discoverable and reusable. The idea here is if we have good metadata describing the resource, then people can find the resource, because they're able to search metadata rather than searching entire documents. It's faster, it's easier, and if you use a standardized vocabulary, it can be quicker. And because you have this metadata, you're able to take that resource and put it right into a package of contents where it belongs. So you can bring associated resources together and create something larger out of them. That led to a second IMS specification called content packaging, which was a mechanism for bringing together a bunch of resources, putting them into a resource package, and distributing them that way. This is the sort of technology that underlies things like electronic books and electronic learning resources that are now being distributed on things like the Kindle or the iPad. There are other technologies as well. And I'm not going to start throwing alphabet soup at you, because there's a whole bunch of technologies. But again, the idea of these technologies is very simple at heart. The idea of these technologies is to formalize the description of the resources and to formalize the presentation of the resources. It's to take something that's kind of messy and make it neat enough for computers to use. One second. Must have coffee. Excuse me. Okay, so that's the first phase. And there's a slide here from Zed Ali Alsagaf from Malaysia, free learning content, listing a bunch of the open educational resources. There's a whole pile of projects. The most famous is MIT's OpenCourseWare. There's connections from Rice University, OOPS from Taiwan, Merlot, which is a consortium of North American universities, and so on. I can't even list them all. If you go to that site, he lists those. And you might be asking, well, how can I go to a site because I can't even read the URL? These slides will be made available as an open educational resource under a Creative Commons license on my website. My website will appear as the last slide of this presentation in big print, and it's short, so you won't have any problem writing it down. If you want to come back to my website and see these slides, and then you can follow those links. And that's how open educational resources work, right? You create a resource, you put it up on the web, and then you tell everybody, here it is, come use it. Okay, well, that's phase one. Moving on into phase two, and there's really two stages to phase two. We'll call it the old phase and the new phase. I just made that up. We've got learning resources, but the history of distance education, as promoted by these organizations like School of the Air, like Open University, like Athabasca University, they didn't just throw stuff at you and say, here, learn. Well, they did, kind of. But they tried to throw structured stuff at you and then said, here, learn. There's a... What they did is, in addition to textbooks and perhaps kits. I signed up for an Athabasca psychology course once because the deliverable in the course was a plastic model of a human brain. I wanted a plastic model of a human brain, so I signed up for the Athabasca course. I never got the human brain, and I failed the course. Oh well, I'm not saying one caused the other, but anyhow, in addition to these resources, the Athabasca and other open learning agencies would send a course package, and the course package would be created in such a way as to step you, the learner, through the learning material. And of course there's a whole instructional design process that goes into the creation of those things. And that process has carried over into the world of online learning. Now, the original idea here was that it would just be a sequencing of the material, and so IMS came up with something called simple sequencing. But of course, you know, in the classroom, we do much more than simply sequence materials. In a classroom, there's a much more choreographed delivery of instructional materials, but also instructional activities. Rob Koper of the Netherlands, of the Open University of the Netherlands, is where he is now, came up with something called the Educational Modeling Language, which described this. And basically, the Educational Modeling Language was a mechanism for defining different roles in an educational scenario, as well as the resources and the activities that they would undertake. This was adapted by IMS, and it became something called learning design. And so the idea of learning design is, if you describe this learning design formally in the learning design language, and you provide that learning design as well as the aforementioned educational resources to a learning management system, then the learning management system will perform the function of the instructor in choreographing the activities of a group of people in an online learning environment. It's very ambitious. It was way too ambitious. And although some learning design players were created, learning design never really was taken up in any big way. Guillaume Durand and I wrote and published something just last year, I guess it would be now, called Simple Learning Design, which is a modified approach. I've also got a link here to Diana Lorillard and Pedagogical Patterns, which again is kind of a simplified learning design. The concept here, though, is the same in all cases. The concept is to try to take not just the content of learning, but the pedagogy, and in some way make this pedagogy deliverable as well. And that's led to the second part of phase two from people like Grunje Knoll or Ulf Daniel Ehlers on open practices. And the idea here is to try to draw out, explain, formalize in some way, and then make open common educational practices. So an instructor, say, will have a repertoire of practices that they can draw from, as well as a repertoire of learning resources. And then you take the two together and you have some kind of open learning, but it's still not completely open in the sense that you're still, I don't want to say it's still not completely open. It can be completely open, but it's a certain view of openness. George Siemens and I took a different approach, and we kind of threw the practices out the window. And instead, what we did is we offered something called the Massive Open Online Course. And instead of trying to choreograph the learning process for a group of people, we opened it up completely. Where, and attempted to arrange it such that people or groups of people would choreograph their own practice. Sorry, just got to type something quickly. Oops, there we go. And so we created basically a network of connected learning resources. And you can see the nifty diagrams there, which were all created by participants and not by us, describing the MOOC. And you can see how what we did was to connect things like Illuminate to Facebook to Twitter to Grasshopper to various other technologies. And what we did basically is we told the participants, you use your own technology, whatever that technology may be, whether it's a blogging engine, whether it's Facebook, whether it's simply your web browser and access to online sessions like this one, whatever. And you organize your learning yourself. We're not going to step you through some sort of choreographed pedagogy. That's your responsibility. What we will do is provide the infrastructure that makes that sort of thing possible. So we create the space, we provide the resources, we provide all the facilities that you need, but you manage your own learning. And you might think that could not work. But we've been experimenting it for a few years now. I've offered a total of 5 courses on this model. George has offered 5 or 6. They overlap to some degree. Other people are offering these courses, and maybe it does work. There are a few things that are really necessary. The big thing that's really necessary is people need to have, if you will, this learning literacy. They need to be able to manage their own learning activities. And again, it's not something that happens by magic, but also it's not something they can't do. I will draw the analogy back to literacy, right? It used to be the case that people accessed books by having them read to them. Maybe the preacher would read out of the Bible, or maybe the Lord would read out of a book, and all the peasants, I don't know if that ever actually happened, but you know what I mean. People couldn't read, so they would have people read for them. People couldn't write, so they would have people write for them. But that seriously limited the usefulness of language, especially written language. And so people learned to read and write for themselves. The MOOC is an attempt to set up the same sort of condition except for learning. People learn to learn and to teach for themselves. And what the MOOC is kind of like the library in which that takes place. Now again, it doesn't mean it happens by magic. It means it doesn't happen by magic. It happens with an awful lot of anguish and screaming, if our experience is anything. But people do learn. They do learn to learn in these MOOCs, and they learn from these MOOCs. That's what our evidence shows us. Obviously, there's a lot more to be done. There's yet another phase of open education. And that's the phase that hasn't really happened yet, and that's the phase of open assessment. When I say it really hasn't happened yet, it's sort of beginning to happen. If you're in the college sector, you know about prior learning assessment and recognition, or PLAR, or sometimes called RPL, recognition of prior learning. If you're in the tech field, you know about certified Novell examinations or Microsoft A Plus certification. If you're an accountant, you know about CGA. If you're a lawyer, you know about the Bar Association. If you're a coder, you know about things like BrainBench. And there are various other initiatives. We're in the very early stages of open assessment and what will follow almost inevitably, I think, open credentialing. The idea here being that it doesn't matter what you read, it doesn't matter how you learned, it matters only that you can show that you have the knowledge, you can perform the task. And, you know, I mean, again, this isn't going to happen by magic. You can't just give people, you know, a 5-question true-false test and determine that they're a brain surgeon. That's just not on. But the kind of technologies that we're looking at that support open assessment are the kind of technologies now that we call games, or simulations, or social networks, where the recognition of one's learning will be the performance of authentic tasks in authentic environments with a genuine, real audience. But this all comes back to openness. None of this works without openness. Just like language cannot be used unless people have access to the words to speak and listen to, unless they are literate and able to use those words to create their own creations. Similarly, open learning, whether it's open learning resources, whether it's open courses, whether it's open assessment, can't work without openness of learning itself. And so that's why I talk about the horizon of online learning. It's the openness that is going to transform learning into something that really is the privilege of a few, to something that is as striking and as important as literacy is in our society today. And that's the presentation, and as promised, there's the URL to my website in big letters if you want to see the slides. The slides aren't up there yet, but they will be up there, let's say, within the next 12 hours or so. Give me a little time because I have to go to sleep first. So thank you very much.
Oh. There we go. Now I'm on. Thank you, Stephen, very much for your slide. I think there was definitely a lot of key points there. I think the important one was really making sure that, through that openness of learning that we do make it accessible and forget that, you can't just throw something at someone and think that they're just going to get it. You really have to structure that particular online sort of process. You've got to really create the access to the learning for them. I think it's also quite interesting how there are, or how the online learning really has quite evolved over a short period of time, and that there are a lot of free resources out there that people can use under that Creative Commons license, and that you don't always have to start from scratch, that there are places where you can start from. So I think that was quite some useful information for us. Now I'm not sure whether you can see it or not, but we have got a certificate and a little gift for you, which I'm sure will probably be posted, I would imagine, out to you. So thank you very much, Stephen, for your very engaging, and I think it's quite good that we're able to illuminate and actually, since our forum is about online learning, actually do something that was online. So I think that's really quite in theme with the whole PD forum. So please, let's thank Stephen for his presentation.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be able to speak to you, and I certainly hope that you have a great conference while I'm sleeping. So thanks, and I'm going to sign off now. And for those of you who are listening on Ed Radio, I'm just wrapping up here, and I'd like to thank you for joining me. And we'll, I guess, wrap up the broadcast as well. And I'll just play a little music to give you an outro. Thanks for joining us.